Welcome to Level 20, a new podcast from Level 1 Productions, exploring two decades of Level 1 films. Each week for the next 20 weeks, we're going to be going in depth on a film from Balance, Level 1's first movie. It came out in 2000, all the way to Romance, the 20th film that'll be coming out this fall. These are designed to be listened to after having watched the movie. So if you're listening now, go watch the movie first, because you're going to get a lot more out of it having seen all the stuff that we're going to talk about. I'm Connor Smith. I'm the summer intern here at Level 1, and I have the great privilege of being able to interview the people behind the scenes here at Level 1 who have inspired me for a long time and talk to them about these movies. These first couple are going to be just with Josh Berman. He is the owner, director, operator, editor, producer, and sometimes babysitter to the stars here at Level 1. After the first couple, we're going to be talking with Friedel Cody, the co-director here at Level 1. And as it goes on, we might also have interviews with some of the other people behind the scenes and in front of the camera. Who knows? It will be an evolving process over the next few weeks. And we really would love to hear your feedback and your input and any questions that you have for Josh or Friedel. So if there's anything you want to hear about from a particular year or a particular movie or a story you might know about that I can surprise one of them with, please send it to podcast@level1productions.com. Hope you enjoy. Thank you for listening. And without further ado, here is Balance. Josh, how are we doing today?
We are doing all right here, Connor. First off, thank you so much for putting this together. This is an exciting opportunity, for one, for me to be forced to watch all of the old movies, which is something that I haven't done in a very long time. Mm-hmm. And secondly, to provoke and prompt me and the rest of our crew to tell some really interesting stories.
Yeah, two decades is a lot of stories.
That is a lot of stories. I'm not going to talk for two decades about the last two decades, but I probably could if I had to.
Uh-huh. So, elephant in the room. This year, it's kind of an open secret that this is going to be the last annual Level 1 film for a while.
I'm going to correct you. Last annual feature film. And I choose those words very carefully. Mm-hmm. We are going to press pause on the annual feature film formula, which we have been doing, as you've mentioned, for 20 years straight. For a number of reasons, but I'm not going to say that it's our last feature film, but just as far as us committing to produce another feature film that's going to come out another 12 months from now, that's not going to happen.
Hmm. What do you think are the pros and some of the cons of doing one every year?
The pros, well, in a lot of ways, the annual feature film has allowed us to establish Level 1 as a brand. Hmm. It's something that is relatively consistent as far as what we do, how we do it, the voice we use to speak to our audience, and the fact that every September or October, one of these films comes out, and to a large degree, our audience somewhat knows what to expect. And it is that consistency that has allowed Level 1 to really stand for something, and people recognize it as a very specific thing within the skiing space. So that's one of the pros. Another pro, I guess, is that it keeps us busy. That's for sure, but I guess that's also a con. Mm-hmm. And that's probably one of the biggest reasons why we are not going to be producing the 21st annual feature. More pros, it has certainly given us very singular insight into the development and the changes within the sport. I feel like I've seen almost the development of free skiing as we know it start to finish. In fact, I feel like I have, and I've shot the vast majority of it along the way, which has given me, I think, a very unique perspective. More pros, it has allowed us to meet some amazing people, make, you know, certainly our set of friends all over the world, visit amazing places. I mean, kind of the things you'd come to expect with producing an annual feature ski film that requires you to work with the best athletes in the best places. Cons, it is, it keeps us busy.
Yeah.
It is to a large extent, a grind. It's, you know, in some ways Groundhog Day with the formula that we've kind of created for ourselves and for what level one is. We have a almost 12-month cycle to start a film, produce a film, shoot a film, edit a film, and release it, which has not allowed us a lot of time and opportunity to really expand our business into other projects and do a lot of the things that I'd like to do outside of these annual features. It also, for a lot of the same reasons that it's allowed us to develop this level of consistency that I just mentioned, we've created a mold for ourselves. Like, level one is, we have a very specific approach to producing our films. And for better and worse, I don't think there's a ton of leeway that we have within that mold to tell a lot of stories, to just go too far down some of the creative paths and mixing things up that I really like to do, just because our audience comes to expect a certain thing, and we can sprinkle a few other things in the mix, certainly, but when somebody puts in a level one movie or goes to premiere, they're going to expect a collection of the best and most diverse action that was shot in the past 12 months on skis. And I feel pretty confident that we usually deliver that year in and year out.
Since the internet has, I'll say, killed the annual feature ski film, what does it mean to still be making these when a lot of the contemporaries that were making them when you started are no longer around?
Sure. It's first and foremost, I think it's kind of sad to see what the internet and social media has done to ski films. I grew up as a super fan of ski movies, and I don't think there's ever going to be a replacement for being able to gather with a bunch of friends in a living room or at a concert venue or wherever else you're going to go watch a ski film premiere. I don't think there's ever going to be a replacement for that. The internet is certainly not it. And it makes me sad to see a lot of that having gone away. And there's that level of, for lack of a better word, stoke that you saw at those premieres. And we'll get to it in a second, but I think you still see it these days. It's kind of, there are no secrets. There are very few. When something happens, oftentimes it is shared almost instantaneously online, and it is a blessing and a curse. It has allowed people access to the athletes. It's allowed the fans access to the action, and it is, you know, an unfiltered 24/7 stream of cool shit happening around the globe, being recorded on phones, being recorded on other cameras and pumped through phones. And it's exciting, but it's numbed a lot of people to what goes into producing this content, because they come to expect it as a nonstop stream. And it has also made it harder to engage an audience and keep them interested in you know, a feature length piece of content. And I don't know, in a lot of ways, some of the more successful ski films that I've seen in the past 5 or so years have been very untraditional. I think that's kind of a reaction to the action that we're seeing through all the social media channels. And I don't think it really pushed us to change things as much as maybe we could have or should have. But again, it kind of goes back to the mold that we built for ourselves and trying to stay true to what the level one brand and style of filmmaking is. And so I don't really regret not going too far off our path.
So let's rewind to those superfan days that you're talking about. What movies did you grow up watching? What sticks out from your childhood?
For sure. I think my earliest memory of watching a ski film, I might have been 10 years old, and it was in a family friend's vacation home in southern Vermont. And I remember a Warren Miller segment where everybody's falling off the chairlift and getting smoked in the back of the head. And you've seen it before. And it's kind of the consummate Warren Miller, comedy part that he probably, did 1,000 times. But that's one of the first things that I remember seeing on a VHS tape that we popped in, or maybe even rented from a local video store. But that's probably my first memory of watching a ski film. And then I got really into it when I worked in a shop in Armonk, New York, called Hickory and Tweed. I was cleaning boots with this super toxic, cancer-causing, evil solvent that I used to have to just use a rag and just, like, basically melt the plastic in the boots to clean them up and make them look pretty. It was pretty fucking brutal. If I ever get brain cancer, that's probably where it's from. But they did have a showroom and a sales floor, and they had a TV and VHS copies of all the movies that were coming out at that time. Nice. And there were a bunch of Greg Stump movies, which definitely made an impression on me. The one that really stood out was a Rap Films movie called The White Room. And the reason it stood out, they had a segment with Trace Worthington and I'm trying to remember who else, on the Windlip in Whistler, British Columbia, up right off the glacier. And it was one of the first times I'd actually seen freestyle skiing, like a cool version of freestyle skiing featured in a ski movie. And I could watch it for like the whole 4 minute part. And it didn't have any other bullshit in it. It was just people jumping, which is what I was into and what I was doing at that point in my life. So it was something that made a huge impression. And then, eventually, before I started Level One and when I was in college, I was a big fan of Poor Boys and Matchstick and TGR. I remember getting a copy of a bootleg copy of Johnny DeCesare's State of Mind, which at that point it was the first like full-length feature film that I could watch and appreciate every single second of it. It was just all the freestyle shit that we wanted to see. It was all new. It was all stuff that I had never seen before. And to me, that was so exciting. And I actually watched that copy until I wore through the VHS tape. Damn. And there were definitely parts of the movie that you couldn't watch anymore because they were so messed up from being cycled through the VCR 2,000 times. But I went to school at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. There wasn't much of a ski scene there, at least the kind of skiing that I was interested in. But
You weren't on their D1 race team?
Well, funny, because I was still competing as a mogul skier and an aerialist the first year or so. I think my freshman year, I actually took that winter off to compete. And I proposed to the coach of the Alpine team that I'd be allowed to train with them dry land in the fall. Just because I wanted, for one, a group of skiers to hang out with. I wanted to be motivated. I wanted to surround myself
with some community.
Some community. This dude told me to go fuck myself. I was like, oh, cool. Thank you, Alpine skiing community. I love you guys too. That's great. So clearly there's no connection to be made there. But I continued to do my thing. And I was chairman of the programming board at Dartmouth for like 4 years or 5 years, and got to run concerts, and I was given a really healthy event budget and got to do all kinds of cool things. And one of the things I did with that event budget was run ski film premieres.
Nice.
And I ran a whole bunch of premieres. TGR, I think I brought the Freeze East Coast movie tour to Dartmouth. I remember having beers in my frat basement with Seth Morrison and the jerk from Freeze magazine. I think Micah Abrams was there. It was a pretty funny scene. And definitely those are the kinds of people that I was really inspired by and really wanted to connect with. There's also a funny story where I got sold on a $3,000 super mega premiere package from Matchstick, which ultimately meant that a bunch of these dirtbag guys showed up in an RV, set up a projector and a screen and some speakers, and took $3,000 to play Global Storming
for the do what you could have done as the event coordinator.
Exactly. I mean, I forget what was promised, but I mean, I was excited about it. I thought it was great, but I remember definitely being reprimanded. It's like, you spent $3,000, and like, what'd you get out of it? Like, you rented the movie.
You paid for their kegs.
It's like, ah, but Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, I can't imagine what would happen nowadays if I tried to sell a premiere screening for $3,000. Maybe just because I was so excited, I didn't blink, I didn't think twice about it, but it was pretty funny.
So when you're watching all these old flicks, are you thinking, I want to go make that movie, or are you thinking, I want to go ski in a movie like that?
At that point, it was, I want to ski in a movie like that. So mm-hmm. again, I was competing in moguls and aerials and actually acro ski before I went to college. But, you know, my first couple of years in college, I was taking the winter trimester off. And at first, I think that first year, I was still competing in moguls and aerials. And then I quickly came to the realization that I was not going to be able to keep up with the people that were doing it full time. I was pretty good, but competing against people that were doing it 12 months a year, like, I was not going to be on the U.S. team. I was not going to go to the Olympics. That just wasn't in the cards.
Right.
And this was like 97, 98. And right around then, twin tip skis were being developed. Like, twin tip skis, modern twin tip skis as we know it. And I happened to be in the right place at the right time and ended up being sponsored by Dynastar. This is super early on. They had something called the Rip Stick. It was a 151 centimeter semi twin tip ski. Like, you'd laugh right now because the tail wouldn't really go up that much. And moreover, it came from Europe and they gave it to me with these like 10 centimeter riser plates under the binding because they thought it'd be like fun to carve on too. And it was like this weird, like, I don't know, half step between the parabolic skis that were, you know, kind of the saving grace for ski sales in the late 90s and into, you know, the twin tips as we know them today. But it was this like short, funky, supposed to be like super fun ski to rip around in. And so anyway, early relationship with Dynastar and actually Spy Optic back in the day. I think it was actually like a year or two after, maybe 3 years after Spy as a brand was founded. And then a series of all these random clothing companies that I worked with. But anyway, I would have loved to have been on the other side of the camera. I think that was the original inspiration. And right around that same time, I started studying filmmaking photography and taking winters off to compete and train and try to travel. And then it was January of 2000. I was skiing the Pipe at Stratton. I think it was their opening day of the Pipe. I landed a little back seat on an alley-oop 5 that was probably like 6 inches above the lip. And I didn't crash, but I heard a pop. Heard a pop and felt a pop, which is, I guess, like what I've been told, like that means your ACL is gone. And I immediately went down to the ski patrol at the bottom and said, I think I just blew my ACL. They tugged on it. They did their thing. They're like, I think you're okay. I was like, listen, like, I've never felt or heard something like that come out of my body before. Like, that's not natural. So I ended up going to see an orthopedist. I got an MRI. He came back and told me good news and bad news. The bad news is you have no ACL. The good news is you probably tore your ACL at some point in the past and you had a bunch of scar tissue in there that was really kind of holding things together. And that was the scar tissue that you heard popping. So there's nothing in there now holding anything together, but it wasn't elastic what you just tore, and your legs are pretty strong. You can just go out and do what you want to do. And of course, 21-year-old me, that was like the best thing I could be told. Like, I just, you know, again, committed to taking that term off from Dartmouth for the winter season, and I didn't want to go back to school. I wanted to be told that I was invincible. And so I thought I was. And I think I took a week off. I was a little concerned for sure. It felt like if I went to kick a soccer ball, there'd be nothing to stop my leg. And that's how I remember describing it to people. And, the orthopedic surgeon got me a prescription for an over the counter brace. It was like $60 or $70, this little piece of shit thing that did absolutely nothing. And 2 weeks to the day after I, you know, tore whatever was in there was the first morning that I got a new twin tip prototype from Dynastar. And this was a legit, for the time, again, twin tip ski. It was their answer to the 1080. Shit, what was it called? I'm spacing. Concept. It's called the Dynastar Concept. And I hit a little jump, probably like a 10-foot table. But it started dropping in where I had previously been dropping in from with the not really a twin tip. And I probably went like 35 feet over this, you know, well, maybe it wasn't 10 feet, but it was, I like went, you know, twice as big as I should have and landed so far in the flats doing switch 180 and my whole left leg folded over backwards because, of course, deferring to that kicking a soccer ball analogy, there was nothing to stop it. And at that point, I knew immediately, like, shit was bad. I was probably in shock. I refused to get help from the ski patrol.
Yeesh.
I skied down one ski in, like, as bad pain as I've ever been in, went right back to the ski patrol at the bottom. I mean, at that point, they're just like, yeah, this is not good. And my knee swelled up to the size of a watermelon. And I did lateral and medial meniscus, shattered tibial plateau, and, you know, just, like, made a fucking mess of it.
Jesus.
And at that point, I had to wait 5 weeks of non-weight bearing before I could even get surgery because it was so swollen, it was so fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
And that ultimately was the end of what, looking back, probably would have been a very mediocre professional skiing career if I had continued down that path. Because again, like, I was pretty good, but, you know, the sport was going in a direction where I don't think I would have been able to compete at, like, the upper echelon. And I would have tried. And, you know, there were a lot of people at that point in time in particular that established skiing careers that were as much or more based on their ability to market themselves than their raw ski skills. So I probably would have been okay for a couple of years, but it definitely would not have been sustainable. And I probably would have ended up getting hurt even worse eventually. So at that point, I didn't quite know what to do with myself. I just knew that I didn't want to go back to school that winter. I had been shooting with a photographer friend of mine named Jeff Winterton, who was probably, you know, 5 or 6 years older than me at that point. And Jeff was really responsible at that point for bringing together what was the new school ski scene on the East Coast. He was a huge catalyst for everything that was going on. In fact, if he wasn't there, there'd probably be no Level One, and it would have definitely taken somebody else to replace him a year or two down the line to really put together a crew of like-minded individuals that were pushing twin tip skiing. And at that point, you could probably count on one hand the number of people that actually had real twin tip skis, would hit jumps or land backwards. And Jeff knew and connected every single one of those people. He also had connections to the folks at Freeze and Free Skier magazines. And he was kind of the glue that, you know, put it all together. I remember talking to him, I guess it was probably a few days or maybe a week after, you know, the actual knee explosion, and you know, saying, I don't know if it was his idea or my idea. I might have come to him and said, I think I want to make a ski movie. But whether it was his idea or mine, he was so supportive. His response was basically, you know, fuck yeah, like, let's do this. There's no reason why not. And initially, it was just to keep me busy and occupied so I didn't have to go back to school for that winter, hoping and assuming that my knee would be back to 100% and then just go back on the path of trying to be a professional skier athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, we know how that worked out.
Right.
Sitting here 19 years later and change 20 years later. But yeah, I mean, massive thanks and props to Jeff Winterton, because we would not be here today but for Jeff.
Sick.
And he definitely gave me the confidence and really the inspiration and all the tools that I needed on day one to get the ball rolling.
Did you already own a camera at that point? A video camera?
You know, I think I did. It was a Sony digital 8 camera that I think I had borrowed from my dad. I'm trying to remember the exact sequence here, but I mean, we're talking like single CCD, single chip, records a digital signal to a tape, of course. And that's how I shot the first half of Balance. And right before I went out to Whistler, that's when it was starting to get serious. So we took a couple trips that spring. And it's like, okay, cool. We're making a ski movie. I think I borrowed a Canon GL2 from somebody at my school, or maybe the school owned it or something like that. But the Sony VX2000 was like the flagship of the action sports video camera at that point. And that was three CCDs. And I remember reading something online that said that it was better than 16 millimeter. And I was like, oh, this is it. This is like professional level. And it was $3,000. And I borrowed that $3,000 from my dad. And to this day, that is the only money that I ever borrowed to put into anything Level One related, aside from the office building. Man, that's a different story entirely.
Yeah.
But as far as just like startup costs and everything along those lines, that was it. And I think it might have taken me like 6 months to pay him back, but I did. And yeah, but that Sony VX2000, I think we still have the one in the gear closet.
No way.
Yeah.
What do you think of a lot of the stuff that's getting shot on VX today? Because there's a lot of it.
I think it's cool. I mean, it's like listening to music on vinyl.
Yeah.
You know, it's everything has a purpose. And, you know, there is a stylistic approach to shooting with, you know, borderline analog. Because that's what it was. It was putting a digital signal on an analog tape.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, everything serves a purpose. And I think the pendulum swings back and forth. And there comes a time when it's nostalgic and it's interesting to look at this little 4x3, you know, 480p, or was it like 240p? I mean, it's like a thumbnail. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's funny because I was going through Balance and trying to make Instagram clips a couple of days ago to promote this podcast. Mm-hmm. And I had to scale it up because you have to export for Instagram in 1080p. And it was this tiny little thing. I had to make it like 500% to fill the space. And yeah, it was pretty funny.
Yeah. So you got the VX. You took that to Whistler.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where you ended up linking up with a bunch of these people who are in the film? Or yeah. Did you already know some of these dudes and lady?
So we all knew, again, everybody that was doing this kind of thing on the East Coast had some kind of connection. And it might be like one person removed, but not more than that, because it was such a small community.
Right.
And, you know, the sport at that point was so small and so tight-knit that everybody kind of knew everybody in some way. And let's see. In the very early stages, I was really good friends with a guy named Josh Novotny, who was on the Mount Snow Snow Force free ski team, which at the time was the first and only resort that had ever put together some sort of free ski team. And so Josh Novotny from Manchester, Vermont, and I were on this team. Jeff Winterton was on the team, and he was also the photographer for the team, because mm-hmm. you could double dip at that point pretty easily. And let's see, these two crazy kids from Ottawa, Garrett Britton and Scott Hibbert, had somehow connected through to Josh Novotny and I want to say through one of the online forums. It probably wasn't even New Scores at that point. It might have been like the Poor Boys message boards or something.
Wow.
Yeah. And or Freeze Online, I think they had one too. But anyway, so these kids came down to like hang out in Mount Snow and stay with Josh Novotny and his family, and Jeff Winterton and I stayed there too for a few days, and just became instant really good friends. And that turned into Jeff putting in a proposal for a Mountain of the Month trip to cover, I want to say like Mont Saint-Marie or something like that.
Proposal to
Freeze Magazine. They used to run a feature called Mountain of the Month. I think that's what it was. And I think it was Mont Saint-Marie. But anyway, resort put us up. We go up for, you know, 4 or 5 days in like late March. And there was another crew of semi-local athletes that I think had heard that we would be there. And so they were kind of hanging out too.
Did they know you were making a movie? Was that out there? Or?
I don't know if they knew who I was or what level one was as much as they just probably knew that there's like some sort of shoot going on.
Mm-hmm.
And they built us this really bad, probably like 40-foot jump at the bottom right in front of their base lodge. And there was one of the people hitting it was doing a bunch of sevens and kept crashing tens. And at one point, this person just tomahawked like a half dozen times down this landing, and their helmet flew off. And they stood up, and this long mop of blonde hair popped out, and it was a girl. It was Sarah Burke.
Dope.
And, like, every one of us was like, oh, my God. Like, who is that? What is going on? And that's when we first met Sarah, and she instantly became everybody's best friend. And I think at that point, we were already planning on going out to Whistler, which is where everybody in the scene went for the summer months.
Mm.
And Sarah probably said something along the lines of, oh, like five of my friends and I, we've got a condo for the summer. You guys can come stay for the whole summer. It's like, great. Just like, damn. Let's put three or four more people in this like two bedroom condo. Sounds awesome. And, yeah, I was like 16-year-old Sarah Burke and a bunch of her friends. And we went out and ended up spending the summer with them. I know Garrett was there. Corey Grinnell, another one of the Ottawa crew, was there. Scott Hibbert was there. And, yeah, we spent the whole summer hanging out, shooting what became the second half of Balance. And, of course, like I said before, the scene was so small that you're instantly just like, connecting with everybody there. It was summer camp in a way. You'd go up to somebody and be like, hey, what's your name? Where are you from? Oh, nice to meet you. I mean, it was like that kind of atmosphere where, you know, everybody was new and there were no barriers to talking to people and kind of like, you know, being part of this little club.
Mm. Were you guys coaching at camp?
Oh, no. We were just hanging out, just shooting. Just, I think Sarah was probably coaching, and a couple of the guys might have been doing some like guest coaching stuff at one or two of the camps. But we'd pretty much, as a you know, quote unquote film crew, just kind of hop around between High North, which was probably like the big ski camp at that point, Camp of Champions,
mm-hmm.
which was like 50-50 ski and snowboard, and probably had some of the biggest features, and then, SMS, which at that point was probably Smart Mogul Camp, which I think is where Sarah was coaching. And we just kind of like hop around from one lane to the next. And, you know, whoever had the best features, we'd hang out and shoot them until they kicked us out. And then we'd come back later.
Was that your first summer in Whistler?
That was my first summer in Whistler with that scene. I'd actually gone to a mogul camp in Whistler as a kid, maybe like 16, 17, 18. For a few years. So I kind of like knew my way around a little bit. And yeah, again, just like, you know, different perspective being there filming than, you know, training for something.
For sure.
And certainly when I was last there, the sport as we knew it did not exist. I mean, there was no, like, I was never encouraged to go upside down. And there was no such thing as grabbing your skis. So maybe it was in a few years before, like 15, 16, 17, something like that. But yeah, that was a different time. But things were moving fast.
Totally. That's one of the things that really stuck out to me watching Balance for the first time. I felt like you could see rail skiing in its infancy. Tell me, what was the vibe about rails then, that summer? Like, some people are hitting them, some people are not. Some people look mad uncomfortable. Some people look kind of comfortable.
Yeah.
What was the deal?
Rail skiing was truly... Oh, yeah. Rail skiing was truly in its infancy the late 90s and the very early 2000s. And again, looking at the movies, you can see how quickly it evolved, like unbelievably so.
Yeah.
But in 99, 2000, when we shot Balance, it was so new that nobody quite understood what to do with it. You know, urban rails were pretty much non-existent. Like, if you were shooting or sliding a quote-unquote urban rail, it was usually something in the base area of the ski resort,
right.
And that was it. Or It was the wooden bench that they had at the top of the half pipe set up for the snowboarders to put their boot or strap their bindings in. I mean, it was that kind of thing. It was definitely so far removed from the way we see it today. It's interesting, though, because I think a lot of what we were seeing in rail skiing early on was from skiers that came from an inline skating background, more so than anything else. The first people that I saw and worked with that were actually comfortable on rails, Garrett Britton and Scott Hibbert, and both of them came from an inline background. It's interesting because I just watched Balance myself a couple of days ago and taking notes and seeing Hibbert do a backslide, grabbing his front boot probably, which is a trick that if you saw this year, you'd probably see, you know, Casabon doing it on like a 60-foot down flat down or something like that. But I mean, for a number of years, you didn't see anything like it.
Right.
But then you rewind to January or February of 2000 and you see it there.
That blew my mind.
That actually kind of blew my mind too. I completely forgot about that, but that definitely, you know, is just kind of like harkens back to the inline influences, which is where those guys came from. Mm. And they loved skiing in the winter. They loved inline in the summer. And it's like, oh, wait a second. This sport is going in a direction that we can combine these two things. This is fucking cool. And so let's do it. But it was very new. I actually remember it was something that really interested me because, for one, I think a lot of this came from the East Coast because you didn't have PAL. You didn't have real, quote unquote, real mountains. So, you know, you're left with these icy, shitty snowboard parks and everything that comes with it and just trying to make skiing as interesting as you can. So, you know, you're looking at the what's going on around you and can we slide these snowmaking pipes on the side of the trail? Can we, you know, slide, you know, again, a bench or something else, or, you know, a rail, five-stair rail coming off of the base lodge, you know, after hours when nobody's around. And, yeah, it was very interesting to see, like, people just kind of, myself as well, just figuring out what it even meant. Because even rewind to the fall of 99, when I was still thinking of myself as a skier who was kind of with it at the time, being in the snowboard park at Stratton, which is what it was called, what it was labeled and branded, it was a fucking snowboard park, there was a rail. And I don't remember the exact situation, but I remember being there with a bunch of snowboarders. I'd never slid a rail in my entire life. And either somebody called me out or whatever happened, I felt pressured to go hit it. And it was like, well, here goes nothing. And it was probably like a 15-foot, 2-foot tall rail. But I just remember coming off the end switch just real easy because I didn't know how to stop myself. And that's how it worked out. Just like, oh, wow, like this is a thing. Like skiers can do this. We're going to do this. Damn. And so for me, not only is it because I was from the East Coast and this is what was going on, but personally, I thought it was the coolest fucking thing on skis. And so I was really inspired to push the people around me to pursue that kind of thing and to really document it because that wasn't going on anywhere else. And certainly not in the other ski movies. It's the way I wanted to see it. And it's like, here is a potential opening.
So did you have to cajole or convince people to hit the couple resort base rails that are in the movie? I think in Hibbert's part, he has one. And
yeah, those,
like, you know, talking people into them, or were other people stoked on that too?
At that point, no, because people like Hibbert and Garrett that's what they wanted to do, and they were pushing it on their own. It's interesting. There are a couple of straight up legit, you know, street rails, if you will. Again, they're probably in front of the base lodge in a couple of their local mountains outside of Ottawa. But I mean, that was pretty much the first urban stuff I'd ever seen. They shot that on their own and sent it to me. So I wasn't even there for that. But I mean, they were pursuing that on their own. There was no way. I didn't need to talk them into anything. And not that I'm the filmmaker that ever really wanted to talk people into something, because that's something that we can definitely touch on later, because I think that's an important thing to talk about. But I mean, certainly early on, these things were so low consequence. Everybody's just kind of like, messing around, trying to figure out, like, what can we do on these skis? Like, got four edges instead of two, like, the snowboard set. Like, what are the limits? What are the boundaries? How can we do this? And is it cool?
Right.
And, yeah, we're all just kind of figuring out as we went along.
Yeah, figuring out seems like the motto, looking at some of the setups, because there's a few that made me just, like, scratch my head. There's, like, a camelback, crazy hump rail.
Camp of Champions. Oh, yeah. I mean, that was the other thing, too, is that nobody really knew what was possible, like, what direction is this going to go in? And we'll definitely touch on some of that in the later movies as well, because looking back at some of the things that we shot, we're literally just driving around looking at rails and trying to hit things in cities. Once we go in that direction, is this possible? This is a 300-foot, you know, kind of mellow flat rail. Can we get to the end of it? You know, the kind of thing that we know the answer now. It's like, no, you can't. That's not like a thing.
Right.
But we didn't know any better. So, I mean, we're certainly not going to step to some like crazy steep kink rail, because I mean, that wasn't possible at the time. And that was straight up dangerous as far as we're concerned. So we're just kind of figuring out like, where can we take this? And yeah, I mean, fortunately at that point, I think we're all kind of on the same page as far as just slowly experimenting, like, how do we get speed? How do we get onto a rail? Mm-hmm. Like, do, you know, is it okay to build a 3-foot tall cheese wedge to get onto this 2-foot tall rail? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it was very experimental all the way around.
There's a flat down, I believe, that Tanner hits that's on fire.
Yes. So I'm trying to remember, there was a group, I think in Utah, that I might've shot with TGR, and they somehow lit a rail on fire. And I think everybody thought it was the coolest thing ever. Mm. So for a little while, we're trying to light rails on fire. Like, how do we do that? And it was literally stunt skiing.
Right.
Especially like that winter in particular. Another thing that I found very interesting looking back at balance in particular was that there wasn't really any idea of style. I don't think that there's a lot differentiating people. It was more of like, this rotation is a Misty flip. Cool, let's try that. This rotation is a rodeo. Let's try that. It's almost like survival skills. Like, we're going to set this and we're going to hope we land it. People are starting to do different grabs. Like, yeah, you've got mute grabs. Tail grabs, it was anything behind your binding was a tail grab. There was really no differentiation. But yeah, I mean, it was more like, you know, huck and survive than, you know, we're just learning tricks at that point and learning what's possible, which to me on a rewatch is really something that stood out.
So we mentioned Tanner already.
We did.
There's three names that stuck out from this movie as like really big names still. Tanner, Candide, and Hoji. How were those dudes in the scene then? And do you have any crazy stories from back in the day with them?
Of course. Let's see. So Stratton Mountain was in the late 90s my home mountain. My parents had a place in the town of Peru. It was about half an hour away. And again, at that point when I was starting to work with Dinastar, I'd be there for this East Coast on snow trade show, which was kind of the answer to SIA, but for the eastern half of the country, and certainly focused on product and on snow. And it got to the point where they'd bring in a bunch of these athletes from around the world, at least some of the bigger brands would. And I'd previously met Tanner Hall, I think when he was 14, very briefly, training on the water ramps in Park City, Utah one summer.
Cool.
But I think it was maybe 99 or something like that, but 98 or 99, I officially met Tanner and Candide and a little kid by the name of Mikhail Deschanel, who went on to become one of the sports heroes, in my humble opinion. But Candide came up to me. I think somebody told him that I was a local, and he says to me on the hill right by the pipe, "Excuse me, do you know where to get the good weed?" And I look at him and I don't smoke weed. That was never really my thing. And I was like, oh man, you know, sorry, not really my thing, but my friend over there, and I pointed to somebody, and you're like, he'll definitely have what you want. And turns out he did not speak a word of English, but he'd clearly learned that phrase from somebody as the icebreaker to get him where he wanted to go. And yeah, so I think at that point I had to like physically take him over to my friend and, you know, have him repeat that phrase. But that was my first introduction to Candide, which is pretty damn funny. And then I actually remember somehow driving Mikhail and Tanner Hall around in my Jeep one night, also looking for weed. So I guess that was the thing with these kids when they were 15 or 16, and I think I was 20 or 19, 21 maybe. So that was the first introduction I really had to those guys, at least in the context of this kind of scene. But already at that point, Candide was on Dinastar, and, you know, I was introduced to him as sort of like the savior of, you know, the direction the sport was going, and that he was, you know, this prodigy from France. And it's crazy because people knew that at the time in 98, 99, and yeah, I mean,
and they were right.
They couldn't have been more right. And obviously, you know, T. Hall has stuck around and made an impact on the sport like few others have. It goes without saying. And then you mentioned Hoji. So that's a funny one. He was one of the many kids who I met just cruising around the glacier that summer in Whistler. And for all I know, he could have been or was likely a very accomplished backcountry skier at that point, but I didn't even know what backcountry was. That really didn't mean a damn thing to me. But what I did know and I did see was that he had really good style. And again, you know, I referenced the point that I don't think there was a lot of style going on because it was more about survival of just, you know, can I land a 7? Cool. Can I land a 9? Maybe. Can I land a 10? Probably not, but I'm going to try it. And maybe I'll set it a little forward and it'll kind of turn into a misty flip or not. And there were a few people that summer who had a very intentional approach and, you know, had some early semblance of style. And he was one of them that really stood out to me. And I guess I befriended him, and he ended up with what I assume was his first movie segment ever in Level One's first movie, Balance. And of course, you know, all it is just Whistler Glacier footage. But yeah, you can definitely see that he had something special going on. And he was obviously able to grow his skiing in many ways and still making a big impact today.
Totally. Who else was on that list? People who stuck out, just cruising around. People who made you go, whoa.
That's a good question. I mean, at that point, I was still half shooting with the people who I knew and considered my friends, and then borderline stalking the people who I'd seen in the pages of Freeze magazine. Was like, oh man, there's Skogan Sprang. Like, he's real good. I'm gonna post up and shoot him for a little bit. And I mean, that's exactly what I did. What everybody was doing at that point.
Sure. So Freeze keeps coming up. The first time I saw their name ever was watching these old movies. What were they doing? What was their deal?
Freeze magazine was the core ski new school culture Bible in the very late 90s and into the early, and then the mid 2000s. And they were covering skiing. They were covering the kind of skiing that I wanted to see and that I wanted to shoot, in a very raw way that spoke to, at the time, the 21-year-old me, and before that, the probably 19 and 20-year-old me. It was borderline immature. It was very raw. It had nothing but cool photos of people jumping and grabbing their skis and doing the kind of stuff that I thought was the only cool thing about skiing. And that's
Did they give support to the movie this year at the onset? What was your relationship like with them?
It's funny because I see the Freeze logo on the movie and when I was watching the other day, and I was trying to think of exactly what they did. I think at that point, and I will say no magazine has ever given Level One a dime because that's not how it works. It's always a media trade. It's like, you give us advertising, we'll give you advertising.
Right.
I mean, that's all we ever wanted or needed from them, so it was great. But I'm pretty sure for putting a logo in the intro and on our box and some of the other basic deliverables, we got 2 half pages of ads, which to me was pretty fucking legit.
Yeah, I mean, if they've got the audience, that's sick.
Yeah, to all of a sudden see, you know, a balanced logo and a Level One logo, you know, in the pages of Freeze magazine, like that was so huge and so cool for me. Like I was still fanning out at that point.
Totally. So let's talk about some of the like other individual parts and stuff that stuck out to me watching the movie.
Sure, I actually have a memory really quick.
Do it.
I'm pretty positive that I was in one of the bedrooms at Sarah Burke's condo on the phone with one of the guys at Freeze when he told me that he'd give me like 2 half pages. And I remember it was like the most exciting thing ever.
You made it.
I made it. Definitely made it.
Were you hustling on the business end of things then, even as it's your first movie? Are you trying to, do you have big grand visions or was it making a movie for the homies?
I was really making a movie for the homies. I was making a movie for me, first and foremost, and secondarily making a movie for the homies. And that was really it, certainly at the onset. Because for one, remember, I'm just trying to keep myself busy while my knee heals. There was no idea that Level One was going to make ski movies, that I'd make a second ski movie when we started making Balance. It was just to keep me busy. And you know, with that, I certainly wasn't reaching out to potential sponsors and, you know, having any kind of idea what that even meant. Because I didn't even really need too much money to support it. I mean, we were taking, like, I think the one or two places I flew up to Ottawa to go to that Mountain of the Month thing at Mont Saint Marie, and I flew out to Whistler in the summer. But those were like $250 round trips. And otherwise, we're just sleeping on floors and couches. We're, you know, buying people beers for lodging. And I've got a $3,000 camera. I've got my laptop for school. And that's it. You know, I'm a student. I don't need to make an income. I'm not stressed about it. It's just, this is a fun endeavor and I'm trying to cover my very minimal costs and just from savings from my summer jobs. And that was about it. I think once I decided that it was going to be a real ski movie, which was probably the summer months of 2000, after I got back from Whistler and started putting things together, I think at that point there was some interest in, well, can I get sponsors beyond these 2 half pages that I got for Freeze? Like, what does that even mean? I think I got 3 pair of skis from Lime. Nice. I think that was my sponsorship with them. And I actually remember getting the big cardboard box with these skis delivered to my mailbox at Dartmouth that fall. And promptly selling them because that was the deal. I think I got a bunch of clothes from this defunct brand called Swag. And then otherwise, these kids were helping me with a website. Freeridezone.com was their website, so I put that in there. I mean, it was just like bro deals and some product, and that was it.
Sure.
And again, there really was no grand ambition. Certainly not until, I think, the end of the summer when we were still shooting in Whistler, and I actually spoke to, we'll call him a contemporary who had a video production company and was making his own videos at that point. And he told me at the time that he had just sold 10,000 copies of his latest movie. Jeez. And yeah. And I mean, I have no frame of reference. You know, I didn't know what that meant. I did know that his movies were not very good. The production quality was really lame. And he's claiming 10,000 copies. And, you know, I have no reason to not believe him. And that doesn't sound astronomical. I mean, albums at that point are selling millions and 10 millions.
Like, right.
10,000 VHS is cool. You know, there are 4.5 million people that participate in skiing in North America, so I could sell 10,000 VHS copies. And, you know, if I had had the money, I probably would have bought 10,000 copies of my own movie or had them made to sell them. Thank God I did not. I think we had maybe 2,500 copies made, and maybe, you know, to this day, I sold a total of 1,500, 1,700 VHS copies of Balance.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean...
Congrats, because that's awesome for your first movie, but, like,
yeah,
it's all relative.
It is all relative, and it's just funny thinking back, because, again, like, I didn't have any ambition to do anything with it, but, you know, at a certain point... You know, from speaking to other people that were ahead of me in the industry, like, oh, this is what we do. And, like, knowing what I know now, that dude sold 100 copies, maybe 110, of the movie that he claimed to sell 10,000 units. And, yeah, it's just drunk talk.
Right.
And, I mean, I don't think he was necessarily trying to deceive me, but... I mean, he probably wrote on his media deck that he was sending out to people that he was selling 10,000 copies. So he just felt that was, like, an appropriate lie to disseminate through
media. Tell it for long enough, you should believe in it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, anyway.
Back to Sarah Burke's apartment in Whistler.
Yep.
Her part blew my freaking mind. Like, I think you could put that in a movie today. Like, and I would love, I mean... What was skiing with her like back then? And was anyone else on her level as a female rider?
You know, first off, skiing with her was great because she was just a friend. And she was a friend who was very excited about skiing. And there wasn't even this, like, oh, Sarah's a girl skier. It's like, no, right. Sarah's a skier. And she's just traveling and hanging out with our crew. And that's all there was to it. There was no differentiation, really. I mean, it's like, you know, cute little blonde girl as she wasn't put into that category. She was just cool. Like one of the guys. And that made her all the more fun to just have as part of the crew. And it's actually interesting looking back. I mean, she was with us for pretty much 2 or 3 years straight. She was most definitely a part of this level one crew early on. And there were not a lot of things that we did without her. And it was, you know, a large part due to her skiing ability and her interest in charging and the fact that she just didn't really care to make it a situation where she was a girl. She was just one of the guys hanging out. And she was great. She was like everybody's best friend and just awesome person.
And a ripper.
And a ripper, to say the least. And it's interesting because, I mean, she did so much for women skiing over the years. And it's certainly sad that she's not with us today, but it's crazy because if she was, she'd probably still be doing all those same tricks with just a little more style than she did back in the day. And that would still make her the best girl ruling the scene. And yeah, girls should go back and watch Sarah's part from Balance and take a little bit of inspiration and get a little bit of a kick in the butt and follow her lead.
Go chuck it. Mm.
Yeah, wear a helmet,
right?
But go chuck it into slush too, by the way. Not a hard pack,
right? You mentioned Josh Novotny.
La Boss.
Yeah. Some banger clips, but more than anything, like, made me laugh seeing you interview him in a bathtub and seeing him wheel a keg through the airport. What was the story behind that?
All very real moments. So, again, at that point, we were just all friends skiing and shooting, and there was no grand design. A lot of what we did at that point, I was 21. I think he was 19.
Mm-hmm.
Drink a lot of beer and party. And the bathtub interview was from the Mont Saint-Marie trip where mm-hmm. they put us up in this like ski patrol, like dormitory style lodging. And there was a bathtub and I don't remember whether he was passed out in it and I woke him up, or he passed out in the bathtub after the fact, but that was not really staged. That was just kind of what was going on. And it's like, all right, I'm going to go get my lav mic and we're going to clip you up and we're going to do some talking. And, I mean, that was just like a snapshot of what our lives were like. And he like cracks open this 24-ounce, like Molson perfectly labeled Le Boss beer. And that kind of became the theme for his segment. And I'm trying to remember if there really was a story behind the keg in the airport. I feel like we were just shooting everything. And I think that's probably when we were on our way to or from Mont Saint-Marie. And he just saw some like, you know, restaurant service person wheeling a keg. And I was like, dude, go, just go fucking get the keg. We're going to get a shot. I think that's all there was to it. Cause like, I cannot imagine that we were actually taking a keg to the airport.
Right.
Not impossible,
but you can get kegs where you're flying to. So that usually,
most likely. So, I mean, that
right. Maybe going to Canada to the US, maybe not, but
yeah,
that I just cracked me up. Oh my God.
Yeah, that was Josh Novotny in a nutshell. Awesome human being.
Speaking of degenerate shit, there's a Andy Woods driving the car, gets pulled over. The cop.
What's your major malfunction tonight, son?
Yeah, not friendly.
No.
Is talking about how Andy was just driving on the sidewalk?
Yeah, so that was really super innocent. From what I recall, we were staying in Killington. It was probably April of 2000. That was the shoot in this dirty, like more mud than snow, Killington half pipe. It was probably like a 6, 7, 8 foot tall pipe.
Right.
And just one night, I think Andy did not drink. So he was the only sober person in the bunch.
Good looks.
Yeah, absolutely. We take that seriously. And I don't even remember the context really, but I know that we were driving around in Andy's car, just kind of like messing around. I mean, that's all there was to it. Like probably in the dirt parking lot outside of our condo. And all of a sudden there were lights and a siren. It was just like, what the fuck? And I think I remember that it was like not even a sidewalk, but like a pedestrian path between a lower parking lot and an upper parking lot. And probably just driving up and down the pedestrian path. I mean, it's not like he was like rallying down a sidewalk. And
sure.
It definitely was. There's nobody around. It was super ghost town. And I mean, it really wasn't that big a deal, but this cop was so convinced. He's like, oh, I got these fucking drunk driving kids.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's definitely what was going through his mind. And he was probably so hurt that here's this straight edge, you know, 18-year-old kid who clearly has not actually had a sip of alcohol. And he doesn't really like, what's he going to get him for?
Right.
And so I think at some point his attitude changed, and you know, the end of the clip is like, okay, we'll just go back to your condo, and I don't want to see you again on the road tonight. And that was it. But that dude came out swinging. I'm sure he had his taser out behind him. And yeah, it's a good thing. I mean, Andy was borderline confrontational too, though. He's like, what? Like, definitely wasn't like, I'm sorry, like, what did I do? But yeah, it was pretty funny. I think there's also some amazing content that has never seen the light of day from that night in that condo of Boyd Easley passed out on a couch. I think we had like a twister, like a twister mat, one of those giant things. I think that got put on top of him, and then we just like covered him in cushions and like a bunch of beer cases and stuff. And if I remember correctly, somebody brought up the point, like, he could suffocate under there. I remember saying, oh, it might have been me that even mentioned that he could, like, because I was probably the most responsible person there, if not Jeff Winterton.
Sure.
But yeah, I think that footage exists somewhere. And I remember that we ended up, like, taking all the stuff off of Boyd, and he was, like, completely, like, unconscious and just, like, drenched in sweat. And we're like, yeah, he'll be okay. Be cool. but that dirty pipe shoot ended up generating the cover of the movie that year.
Dope.
That was shot on something called infrared film, for those who don't know what film and infrared means. But Jeff Winterton...
I know film, but I don't have... But I've never heard of infrared film. Tell me about that.
I mean, technically, infrared, I think, is basically like assigning a light value to heat. So I don't know exactly how it translates to 35 millimeter slide film, which is what Jeff Winterton was shooting. Right. But I do know that it would take things like the sky and make them black. And it just gave this funky black and white,
like a nice
super
shot.
High contrast tonality. And Jeff was pretty good early on about experimenting with all these different styles of film. And
cool.
It was a shot of Boyd from that shoot that ended up on the cover.
Dope.
Did you see the hidden bonus feature?
I did when I watched it for the first time, which was 2 weeks ago now.
Okay, so. Well, where Hibbert lands on my head and puts me in the hospital.
No, okay, no. I don't think so. I might have missed this. Tell me.
Oh, shit. It's
the same shoot?
It's the same shoot. So back in the day, I mean, Balance obviously was pre-DVD.
Right.
And in order to do a hidden bonus feature on a VHS tape, you'd have to get to the end of your movie, leave like 5 minutes of black. Okay. Cut in. I mean, it's like a hidden track on an album.
I watched this on the DVD, and it didn't even have a DVD menu. It just played. So I don't. I might have been messing with the settings, but anyway.
Oh no! That's the case, because when we made the six pack in 2005, and we had to actually put those things on DVD for the first time, we didn't do like a real menu. Because there's no need to.
So if I watch the DVD cut for 5 minutes of blackness,
yes.
I'm going to see Hibbert land on your head?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So Hibbert had been landing nines, and we built this super ghetto tombstone in the pipe to help get a little more air. So it's probably putting like 2 feet of vert, if you want to call it that, on like a 6 or 7 foot tall pipe. And at that point, I was shooting pipe wide from the deck.
Mm-hmm.
Like, by where the skier would land, which, you know, looking at now, it's like, that's just not a great idea. But, Hibbert winds up for a 12, and it's like, that's where I want to be. And the reality is, he drifted a bunch further than he had on his 9s, unsurprisingly, and completely out of control, and landed it probably like a foot and a half deep on the deck, and pretty much, like, skied at the top of my head. You can actually watch my wide angle. He comes at me, and then it just, like, blacks out. And then the long lens angle, you can actually see his ski go like this, and my hair goes, super long hair, kind of flips up. And my sunglass lens goes flying. And, it was like my sunglasses were up on my head between the sunglass frame and the wide angle lens of the camera. Took the majority of it, but he did split my head open. I had to go to the hospital. Got 6 staples.
Did the camera make it?
The camera made it. I think I ended up shooting with that camera until I got the VX2000. So another like month and change or something. And I think I still have that camera in my family's place in Vermont. Like, it still functions. It's not good necessarily.
And you still have most of your memories. So,
no. Most of them. Yeah.
That is crazy, though.
Yeah.
Wow. You mentioned Boyd. What? Any, like, a lot... His accent and the interviews with him are, like, just pretty hilarious. I can't fathom that dude competing at X Games, which he talks about. What was hanging around with him, shooting with him like?
Boyd was the man. He's interesting because I think he very much represents what was going on in skiing at the time with the progression from traditional freestyle and mogul skiing to new school skiing. And I knew Boyd originally from my time skiing moguls. He was a little kid at that point on the come up from Flint, Michigan, who was going to school full time in the winter, Carabasset Valley Academy in Maine, Sugarloaf. And it's interesting because watching his segment, I think a third of it is, or a quarter of it is probably him skiing moguls and tossing 720 iron crosses in the bumps. And then... you know, upright aerials is what it was called, which was like the earliest form of like structured big air through like the U.S. SA circuit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I competed in upright aerials, I used to do like a 360, like an iron cross spread eagle with like variations. And Boyd was at the point where he was starting to put in the kind of things that he was seeing the new Canadian Air Force and, you know, some of the early adapters do. And so it's funny because there are a bunch of upright air shots of him doing like 720 Iron Cross tail grabs and stuff like that. Mm. And yeah, I mean, that was really, you know, mixing the two worlds, which obviously we very quickly broke away from anything that had to do with USSA and moguls and everything along those lines. But Boyd definitely was bridging the gap at that point. And Boyd was fucking awesome. I mean, he, you know, I mentioned before that style wasn't really a thing because people were really survival mode. But I think Boyd had great air sense, like really, really fantastic air sense. And I think that put him in a position where really early on, he's able to put a little bit of style and intentionality into the tricks he was doing. And it definitely allowed him to stand out, not only in the contest scene, but certainly in the sport in general. And he ended up with a bunch of big sponsors. And I think for, you know, a few solid years, he was one of the bigger names in the sport, early 2000s.
That's dope.
It's also really fucking funny listening to him talk about getting into X Games that year because he had somehow
gotten an alternate,
gotten an agent, and that agent basically called the X Games organizer like, "Hey, I got this kid, can he come?" And the whoever was in charge was like, "Okay, cool." Obviously, that does not happen anymore. What's really funny though, that same year I had had a spot as an alternate in X Games, in large part due to the fact that I was on the Mount Snow Snow Forest team, and that's where they had X Games. And originally, I probably would have competed and hurt myself and done very poorly. But at that point, I was still non-weight bearing on my left leg, so I had my left leg in this immobilizer, which was this crazy like ankle to mid thigh brace with a bunch of pieces of metal in it, and I was skiing on one ski, my right leg, and just kind of cruising around. And that's another thing that's kind of funny looking back at how many shots of X Games there were in that first movie, because that was again like this time and place where all of a sudden you have all of these people gathering together and you're witnessing progression that's not happening anywhere else. So it was excusable, if not appropriate, to put those shots in a ski movie. And everybody else is doing it too. Remember going like,
well, and it's not on ESPN at that point. Like, where else are you going to see video content from it? Right.
Yeah. And I remember just going toe to toe with, you know, dudes from Matchstick and TGR and Johnny DeCesare, even like on like the knuckle of the Big Air landing. And, you know, of course, at that point, I was still shooting with my little digital 8 camera, and these dudes are just like, "Get the fuck out of here." Like, it's like, sorry, guys. Just going to squeeze in here. Don't worry about me.
Yeah. That's funny.
Oh, yeah. I feel like for a number of years, I had this thing where people in the industry looked at me as this little kid with a video camera because I was not shooting 16mm.
Right.
They were. And I feel like there was a lot of this prevailing attitude like, "Oh, Josh Berman with his video camera." Like, eh. Kind of funny how that works out.
Yeah. Funny to think about sitting here in the office you built. Anyway. There is a POW kicker at 39 minutes in. It looks like you built, like, it got stacked up. When did you guys start building jumps like that, like going out and building a POW jump?
Sure. I wish I could take some kind of credit for that jump. If it's the one that I'm thinking of, again, Scott Hayward and Garrett Britton gave me a bunch of the content that they had shot that year. If it's the one that I'm thinking of, it was like at a gravel pit or something like that.
It looks like it.
Yeah. Outside of Ottawa, I guess. And I mean, once again, it was just those guys really just making the most of what they had available. And they were probably watching what was going on out west and were like, "Cool, like we get fresh snow, we go to the mountains," and the mountains for them, it was the gravel pit.
That's sick.
Yeah, and certainly that was something that we all adopted as we moved forward. But again, like, yeah, early on, we were just kind of all experimenting. And clearly, you know, the name of the game was making the most of what you had. And that's what those guys were doing.
Sure. You mentioned the very idea of going out west. There's some resistance to that in this movie, or even just like a lot of East Coast pride. How has that changed, or has it changed at all after living in Colorado for a while now?
Oh, it's changed a lot. I mean, the quote unquote East Coast pride, and I think you can even reference the subtitle of the film is Balance. Originally it was an East Coast jib flick, and right. Then there was like this little insertion East right. Coast based jib flick, because when we started, it was just me shooting the people that I knew and was hanging out with on the East Coast. And that's all there was mm-hmm. to it. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh yeah, well, we're going out to the Horseman Glacier in Whistler for the summer. So like, it's not all East Coast.
Right.
And then
and you meet more and more people who aren't from sure. the East Coast at all sometimes.
For right. sure. And then at some point I was introduced to or met this guy named Sean Stegemeyer, who at that point was traveling and living with Tanner Hall. Mm. And he had shot content from Gravity Games. He shot a lot of the random stuff of Tanner from Whistler Winter and some other random stuff. And he gave me that content to put in the movie. And I actually think I still owe him $500 for that content. Sean, if you hear this, let me know how I can pay you. I've got $500 for you. Yeah, if I remember correctly, that was what I had kind of just like thrown out. Like, cool, I'll give you $500. And I think that was probably shortly after I had the conversation with the person that told me that they sold 10,000 copies. And it's like, cool, I just got to pay for this. And then I'm just going to sell all these copies. And then I'll give you your $500. And I mean, obviously that never worked out that way. And I don't know. Sean, hit me up. If I owe you something, let me know. I'm good for it, buddy. But yeah, so that's where a lot of the kind of random shots of Tanner and okay. I think like a couple random ones of like Phil Liu and some of these other people that were definitely not at the East Coast, but were like events and like random training things, maybe like Super Park or something. But,
gotcha.
But yeah, I mean, certainly like, the pride was associated with the fact that this was like about initially our core crew and who we were with and where we were. And it was, you know, we were all from the East Coast and that's what we were representing. And then obviously that changed quickly as we kind of expanded beyond the East Coast.
Totally. You still feel that same sense of pride though when you see stuff coming out of the East Coast these days?
Yes and no. I mean, I feel a sense of pride whenever I see cool content
sure.
coming out of wherever. Well, less pride and it's more just like stoked to see people getting after it. But I don't know. It was pretty easy to ultimately leave the East Coast and put myself in Colorado, which is definitely more of a, you know, base camp for making ski films. And
mm-hmm.
but I wouldn't even say that I have, you know, Colorado pride per se. I mean, we shoot all over the world. It's
right.
more of like, you know, pride in the sport and in the people that we work with and the content we produce. And it's really not specific to any geographical region.
Sure. Cool. Last question. What is your favorite shot or favorite segment or both from the movie, having watched it again?
That is really a tough one.
I know. Sorry.
No. I mean, there's so many funny memories and interesting things. I mean, I referenced the thing about initially meeting Sarah Burke when we thought it was probably a dude, and I was shooting from like long lens halfway across the trail. I mean, that definitely stands out to me, and especially in the context of seeing what she went on to do. I mean, that's pretty special. I think, you know, Andy Woods, and I wasn't even there for the moment, so it's not even mine, but, you know, one
doesn't
of
have
the...
To be.
No, I guess it doesn't there have
are,
to be.
Most of them aren't yours these days.
that's true, but a lot of them are. Don't
sure,
forget
I
that.
Know,
I'm in the trenches sure. still, but, you know, I think, you know, Andy Woods...
Yeah.
I've got this. So there is a shot of Andy Woods landing a 1080.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the Stratton Train Park. It was probably late January. So I'm going to say within a couple weeks of me, like, really destroying my knee, I was once again probably on one ski and with my leg in an immobilizer against doctor's orders, and Andy lands a 1080. It was the first 1080 he ever landed. And the shot runs pretty long. He actually skis up to me from, like, you know, the top of the trail after he stomps his 10 and, like, you know, gets in front of the camera and kind of claims it. And I remember thinking in my head as that was going on, holy shit, I've got a shot of a 1080. Mm-hmm. This is a legit ski movie now. Like, this is real. And I mean, that was somewhat of a turning point. I just felt that legitimized, like, it was in the snowboard park.
Right.
And it was, like, not a mogul or upright aerial 1080, just, like, did it and sent it. And, you know, the backside of that story, of course, is that he went on a vacation with his family to Vail the next week, entered the U.S. Open Big Air, took that 10 to 12, and won the whole fucking thing, which... You know, again, like, that's what was going on in the sport, is you have people, for one, coming out of nowhere that have the skill set and the wherewithal to push themselves. And, you know, Andy's like, well, I did a 10 last week. I'm going to try 12 and just, you know, manage to pull it together. And it was this, like, funky head-to-head format. And I think he had to land five of them in a row going through the brackets to eventually win the finals.
Wow.
And, yeah, and I remember hearing about that, of course, maybe, like, the day after it happened or something like that, and just being like, oh, my God, not only do I have Andy's first 10 on tape, but he won the U.S. Open. Like, this is all real. Like, our crew of people is like...
It's happening.
It's happening. It's happening. Another interesting, I'd say, pivotal moment for me is that I remember sitting in my parents' loft of their 1700s farmhouse in southern Vermont when I first started editing. The very first thing that I started to edit was Rory Will's segment. And I remember, like, putting down a bunch of shots to whatever random punk track I grabbed and thinking, like, this looks like all the other ski movies I've seen. Like, this is fucking legit. Like, this is going to be an actual ski movie. And, yeah, I mean, I remember driving then to my parents' place in New York and, like, having these hard drive. No, not that. I guess it was tapes. Funny side note on that. But being like, oh, man, like, I got to, like, safeguard these tapes. Like, nothing can happen to this. Like, these are special. But the other really funny thing, just in terms of, like, the technical process, which I think people will get a kick out of. So I had, I think it was a Macintosh G4 tower, which had a 20 gig internal drive. If there were external drives, I didn't know what they were, and I certainly didn't have one, couldn't afford them.
Damn.
So in order to edit a segment, I had to capture all of a person's content from tapes.
Right.
And it would sit there, Final Cut 1.1.4, I think, at that point.
Damn.
And be like, enter tape 3. I'd do it, sit there for, like, a couple hours while I pulled the random shots from tape. And then I'd edit the part. I'd be done with the part. I would then export the segment to a tape. I would delete everything and then go on and spend another, like, 12 hours importing the next series of shots onto that hard drive.
Because you only have that much space.
Wow. It was, like, just about enough space to have one athlete's content on there at a time. And another interesting thing, like, structurally, like, watching these movies, every single segment has fades to black and either fades up from black or cuts from black.
Right.
Because we could only lay down one segment at a time onto a tape. And we had to do it manually.
And then did you send all of these tapes to whoever put it onto VHS?
No. I had to combine them. I mean, that was the thing. I had to, like, queue it up.
Sure.
And do one segment, and then as close as I could to having like 2 seconds of black between them, dump another part onto that same master tape and basically build a mini DV master. And the crazy thing is too, is that you'd occasionally have glitches and drop frames. So the mastering process requires you to sit there and watch with eagle eyes every single frame as this thing is exporting. And I'd say 30% of the time you're going to have a glitch. And then you have to stop, you have to rewind, you have to cue it up on the black, you have to time it again, and just sit there and hope that this export's going to be good. And then, of course, you do your whole, like, 60-minute movie, and then you have to watch that whole movie and make sure that you didn't miss any glitches in that process. And usually you did one or two, so then you had to time up that segment and try to drop it in with the black on the front and the back and make sure you didn't all of a sudden overlap the segment on the back end. And it was maddening.
You're making me anxious just hearing you describe
it,
this.
It made me anxious. It was usually a 7 to 10 day process once you were done editing all the parts to get all the parts onto a master that worked. I mean, imagine that.
Damn.
Yeah. Yeah. Different times. 2019. That's for sure. That's for sure.
Any other final thoughts?
One other really funny thing, watching these early films, Balance in particular, I was only getting, not inspiration, but more, I thought, instructions from the other ski films and action sports films at the time, what kind of music you put in there. I was listening to a lot of classic rock at the time. I mean, that was kind of my thing at that point in college. But, you know, I didn't like punk. I didn't really listen to punk. Metal was certainly never my thing. But it's like, that's what was in the Matchstick movies and the Poor Boys movies. And it's like, okay, I guess that's what we put in ski movies. So I'd write emails to all these labels and I'd get all these songs that I could use royalty free. And it's so funny that it's just this collection of, you know, a lot of mediocre punk and heavy metal music that, you know, I never listened to on my own accord, but I felt like that's what had to be. That's what a ski movie was. There was no, like, I mean, not that I was even going to be able to, like, get rights to, you know, all the classic rock content that I was listening to. And I was very adamant, especially early on, like, have to have bulletproof paperwork. And the irony is at that point, of course, is that, you know, I was selling, you know, over 1,000, less than 2,000 VHS tapes.
Right.
Nobody would have ever known if I had just taken Michael Jackson, Beatles, and Madonna and put them on my VHS and sold them.
Yeah.
But I took it so seriously because, again, I thought this was like this huge breakthrough and this is going to be all over the world and I got to get all these rights to all these things. And, yeah, I mean, that's just one of the funny side notes. But yeah, I mean, I was not very confident that, you know, we could do things differently. I felt to some extent that we needed to follow the expectations that all these other films and production companies had set. And, you know, we eventually learned that that was not the case.
Right.
But especially early on, I thought that's the way it had to be.
Wild.
Yeah.
Well, it'll be exciting to be talking about where you go different directions too in the coming weeks.
Absolutely. We go a lot of different directions pretty quickly too.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, if you somehow made it through this whole podcast without watching Balance First, go do that because it's awesome.
And it's free this week only.
Exactly. Go do it. Go run it up. Go tell your friends.
Cheers. Josh, thanks,
thank
Hunter.
You.